It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, what will it take to feed 9 billion people by the year 2050? Our guest has ideas on meeting the food needs of a growing population without destroying the environment.
First, now's the time of the year to get some of our plants started inside, including our herbs. We brought back a special guest who loves to talk about herbs. She says they're used in every aspect of our lives, but we don't always think about them. She's here to give us some new ways to incorporate herbs into our lives.
Venus Williams joins us from our Milwaukee studio. She's the executive director of Alice's Garden in Milwaukee. Venus, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to be with you.
Well, we've been thinking about the last time we had you on and the passion that you expressed. We started talking about herbs, so we thought we really got to talk to you simply about herbs because it's clearly something that touches your heart. What's special to you about herbs?
Herbs can be used in every aspect of our life, whether we're talking about cooking or medicinal, aromatherapy, just to beautify a space. So I just love herbs for their healing benefits on many levels.
What kind of healing are you talking about? What kind of things can we do with herbs?
So one of my favorite herbs is lemon balm. And lemon balm is like the go-to herb for me when it comes to digestive issues, when it comes to baking chicken or fish, when it comes to wanting to just cut something that smells fresh in my bathroom. So when we think about herbs, we tend to think about herbs that we are familiar with, maybe oregano, thyme, basil, which are wonderful, incredible herbs, and we think culinary, but there are so many other uses for herbs, especially if we're talking teas and tinctures.
Now, can you describe that lemon balm for us? You mentioned that it's fresh. Does it smell like lemons?
Yes. So it's a lemon-scented herb. Its official name is Greek, and the Melissa officialis comes from Melissa means bee or honey bee. So it also serves a wonderful dual purpose for us in this time of creation when we're losing bees. Bees love lemon balm. So if you want to do something to save the bee population, you could grow lemon balm. It's pretty, it's an invasive perennial. So once you plant it, you will have it for the rest of your life.
So you better love it.
You better love it. It's in the mint family, and it really is great for your stomach. It's great for all things female, as I say. I encourage every woman, if you grow nothing else, you should grow lemon balm, because at every stage of our reproductive system, it's very healing for us to drink lemon balm tea. So I am an advocate of lemon balm, like it is the herb that will save us all. It's also good for high blood pressure. In ancient Rome, it was used for depression. So we have to move beyond just some of the basic uses for herbs that we have when we have great herbs that can serve many, many purposes. Lemon balm is also used to cure cuts. So making a tincture of lemon balm and putting it on an open wound will help heal that wound.
I want to talk to you about that lemon balm tea, because that sounds like something that would be within the grasp of anyone who wanted to start out, try some lemon balm. How do you make lemon balm tea?
So it is so complicated. Let me see if I can do this. You boil water and you pour it over the leaves.
Okay.
So again, I'm just teasing you. So you just want to boil some water. You steep the tea. I use a ceramic mixing bowl. I steep the leaves in there. If I'm making hot tea, I drink it right away and just put the leaves in the bottom of my mug and add a little bit of local honey, of course, and drink it. But if I'm making an iced tea, and I promise you, summer is coming and we will want to drink some lemon balm iced tea, I let it steep for a little longer, maybe a couple of hours, and then put it on ice and serve it. So again, it's just really simple to go out into your backyard or meet us at a farmer's market and get some lemon balm tea and make your own drinks.
All right, you heard it here. Lemon balm can save the world. And by the way, this is our thank you gift to you for $72 or more, pledge of $72 or more. We'll send you a 3-pack of seeds, including lemon balm, basil, cinnamon, and fennel. And we have some ideas about what to do with these herbs on the Central Time Facebook page as well. And let's say you've got your herbs, you've got them going, and you want to, you know, make the best use of them. You want to care for them and make sure that they keep producing. How do you care for your herbs?
You care for your herbs by giving them what I call a little haircut every week. So even if you are not cultivating them for medicinal purposes, or you can't keep up with the cooking uses, the culinary uses for herbs, if you just go out and just give your herbs a little trim on the top. And when I do that, if I'm not drying right away, which we'll talk about a little later, I take them in my house, I put them in vases, and they're throughout the house in every room. So you want to also think about herbs as plants that you can use in bouquets, in displays, as a natural aromatherapy in your bathrooms. I have a house full of men, males, teenage boys, older boys, and let's just say during the summer, my bathrooms are filled with herbs.
Okay, so another use of herbs besides the tea and all the obvious stuff like that, combat smelly socks, I guess.
That's right, right.
Let's talk about one of the other herbs that you're into, cinnamon basil. What do we know about that one?
Cinnamon basil obviously is in the basil family. A lot of people grow traditional basil or holy basil. Thai basil is pretty popular too. I love cinnamon basil, and it's something that I use very often for baking. So there's a lime cinnamon basil cookie that I really love to make, and I believe I shared that recipe also with you for the Facebook
page.
Yes,
and that sounds incredible. Can you walk us through that?
So again, it's just to not be afraid of baking. It's including the normal elements that you would use, you know, flour and sugar. You're just going to grate some fresh lime, and you're going to use some crushed cinnamon basil and mix it in, and you're just going to bake with it like you would bake any other cookie. I also like cinnamon basil for fresh salads. I make a coleslaw with cinnamon basil, and like to put a little bit of cinnamon basil in some of my pasta salads and in some of the other salads that I make. So, you know, we live in Wisconsin, which is not news to anyone who's listening to us, and our growing season seems to be very short. And so you really want to make the most of what you grow and get excited about not just growing food, but using the herbs. I know a lot of people who grow herbs and then they say, oh, I have all of this sage, or I have all of this lavender, or all of this basil, and I have no idea what to do with it. You know, use your herbs. Don't let them go to waste. And there are so many different recipes out there that will invite you to use herbs in really creative ways.
We continue our conversation now with Venus Williams, the executive director of Alice's Garden in Milwaukee. She is teaching us about the power of herbs and how we can incorporate them into our daily lives.
And Venus, let's say that someone is listening right now. They decide to pledge $72 and get a 3-pack of herbs, including lemon balm, cinnamon basil, and fennel. What do they do with those seeds once they get them home? How do they plant them and make sure they don't wither on the vine but grow up to be happy little herbs?
Well, you can start them inside. One of my favorite ways to start herbs and recycle at the same time is old egg cartons. So you can put a seed in each of the slots where an egg used to be with some soil and put it in the windowsill and begin to cultivate your herbs inside. Or you can wait until after the first frost, whenever that's going to be this year, and so directly into the soil. And then you talk to your seeds and talk to your soil and watch them grow. Add a little bit of water and love, and herbs don't need a whole lot of help.
So it's pretty simple. Even if you don't exactly have a green thumb, these herbs are going to help you out.
Exactly. You could start them in pots, in clay pots, on your porch, on your back porch. So they don't require a whole lot. A lot of the herbs don't. There are some perennial herbs that we're not offering at this time that require a little bit more work, but we chose 3 seed packets that are quite simple to begin.
I want to talk about drying your herbs, because obviously the growing season doesn't last forever, and you want to have some herbs to see you through the winter months. How do you properly dry your herbs so that you can use them all year round?
Right, and you want to dry all season long. A lot of people wait until October or November and begin to think about what's coming up the winter and start drying then. But you really want to start drying herbs the minute you begin harvesting herbs. So use some, dry some. And depending upon the herb, you dry them very differently. So herbs such as sage and parsley, your mints, lovage, borage, you're going to hang those. So you're just going to put those together in a bunch. You can put a rubber band or some string around it and hang them from hooks. You can hang them from I went into a woman's house one time and she had herbs hanging from one of her shower rods. So you want them to hang in that way. I like to dry my herbs out of direct sunlight. You think about the sunlight is pulling some of those essential oils from the herbs. And so I dry my herbs out of direct sunlight. But for some herbs, you need to dry them flat, such as chamomile and lavender, because the essence of that herb, a lot of it lies in the flower. And if you hang them, the flowers, the what we call, in some of the cases, the pollen is going to fall out. So you want to dry those flat on newspaper or cheesecloth. But let's say you want to not just dry herbs and use them at another time, but you want to make your own salts from herbs. So I will take a combination of herbs depending upon the seasoning that I want to create. So maybe some thyme and a sage or whatever it may be. I'll cut the leaves, put them on a cookie tray, and then put some sea salt over those herbs. Put it in the oven and turn your light on. Don't start your oven, but put the herbs with sea salt on top of them. Turn the light on in your oven, and those herbs will be dry by day's end. Take that combination out, grind it up with a pestle and mortar, and there you have your own salt blends.
Wow.
So you can do it that way.
That's fantastic. Can I just ask you what you use the salt blend for? Do you use it strictly for different foods?
Right, for cooking, yes. But now, if you want to dry herbs for bath salts, mm-hmm. And for some other things, so at Alice's Garden, we have our own line of herbal products, and we use a lot of our dried herbs in our bath salts. We make a foot soak with dried thyme and calendula, two herbs that are very healing for your feet, with a little bit of tea tree oil. And so once you get into herbs, if you begin the journey of studying herbs, I promise you, you will become hooked and passionate like I am, because you never learn all there is to know about herbs.
Well, one we haven't touched on yet is fennel. What can you tell us about fennel?
So right now, fennel is my favorite tea. Many people think of fennel as a vegetable. So if someone's listening right now, like, fennel isn't an herb, it's a vegetable. And a lot of people use the root or the base that kind of reminds you of a thick celery. And indeed, it does resemble a vegetable, but fennel is actually an herb. So you can use that root or that base, again, in salad, sauteed, roasted. I use the seeds and the fine leaf in tea. So my favorite tea throughout the winter is a fennel peppermint tea that I make and drink. You could also do that as an iced tea. Any tea, any herb that you can do as a hot tea, you can do as an iced tea. I like fennel as a hot tea during the winter months. It kind of has a little licorice-y flavor to it. And you can also obviously use fennel for cooking, but I like it best as a tea or fennel roasted.
Now, you talked some about the health benefits and healing properties of lemon balm. Would you say that fennel has any of those same things?
Every herb has its own particular healing property. Most herbs are anti-micro, antibacterial. So the more we consume things that come directly from the earth that we're growing, the healthier we're going to be as human beings to begin with. So anything that we're consuming that isn't being processed or overprocessed, we already know that that's going to be better for us. Once again, once you begin studying herbs, you will be amazed at the multiple benefits of all of these herbs, even basil. You know, basil is a great tea. We don't think about creating a tea out of basil, but it, again, is another tea. I can use basil in a mix with sage and catmint and some other things as a decongestant tea. So we could be here for hours talking about all of the herbs that I love. And I always say the herbs cultivate me as much as I cultivate the herbs.
Oh, that's a fantastic place to leave it. I'm excited about herbs. Venus, thank you so much for coming on and talking herbs with us today.
You are welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Venus Williams, Executive Director of Alice's Garden, and she was with us to talk about how we can use herbs in our everyday lives.
The world's population continues to grow. By some estimates, we'll add another 2 billion people by the year 2050.
A new series in National Geographic magazine explores the question of how to feed all those people while preserving the natural environment.
Our next guest kicked off the series with the cover story of the May issue. It's called Food, Feeding 9 Billion. Jonathan Foley is with us now. He's director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, first, let's talk about the growing demand for food, driven obviously in part by population increase. Is there more to that story, though?
Oh, absolutely. As you mentioned, there are basically 7 billion people in the world today, but if populations grow the way we expect in the few decades, we'll be at 9 billion. That would be about a 28% increase in the number of people in the world. And most of those people will be added to very poor countries of the world. So that's a real problem. But simultaneously, we have about 3 to 4 billion people in the world already here who are suddenly getting a lot richer than their ancestors were. Think China, India, Russia, Brazil, other places. And they're forming a new kind of global middle class that's eating richer foods, just like Americans and Europeans do. And so as we add more prosperous people to the world right now and more people altogether in the future, we're having a tremendous increase in the amount of food we require, maybe as much as needing a doubling of global food supplies by 2050 if we don't curb our diets, and our population.
How much does this put our environment, our natural resources, at risk?
Well, agriculture is such a big force on this planet. It already uses about 40% of all the land there is on the planet is used to grow food, more than anything else by a large margin. It also uses about 70% of all the water we consume. And also, agriculture is one of the biggest contributors to climate change through things like tropical deforestation, methane from cattle and rice fields, and overusing fertilizers, which can form something called nitrous oxide. So even today's agriculture is a huge impact on the environment if we don't do it better. And if we have to double it by the middle of the century, we could have a real crisis on our hands unless we get smarter.
You know, if you want to start an argument these days, talking about our food and how it's produced is a pretty good way to start. Are we getting polarized when it comes to agriculture?
Yeah, I think unfortunately we are. Well, you know, naturally people are pretty passionate about food. It's part of our culture and our heritage and who we are, and, you know, that's all very appropriate. But I think kind of like climate change and other things, we've gotten beyond cultural polarization. We've kind of gotten political and economic polarization. We just like to fight over these things for some bizarre reason. I don't think that's very constructive because nobody has all the answers. I think we all have some of the answers, and I'd like to see people collaborate more across these divides because no one small group can decide the future of us all. We're all going to have to figure out how to work together and do these things collaboratively, and that would be really much more helpful.
You offer at least some solutions in the article we mentioned earlier. You've got a 5-step plan. I wanted to get a taste of what you're looking to see change. The first step, freezing the agricultural footprint, you say, is a priority. What is that? What do we need to do?
Well, one of the biggest things we do in agriculture that hurts the environment is, especially in the tropics, we're clearing rainforests to grow more crops. And that's really harmful to the environment and often doesn't really benefit people for food security, that is, feeding the world's poor. What we need to do is stop clearing forest and grow, if we need more food, grow it on the land we've already got. And so the first two recommendations are, you know, stop deforestation, and second, grow the food we need on the land we already have and just learn how to grow it better on land we've cleared before.
Well, that involves more intensive agriculture. And speaking of those arguments, some people are worried about what it takes in terms of fertilizer, pesticide, overuse of soil to grow more food on the land we've got. How do we get around those issues?
Well, that leads to the third recommendation, is we could be far more efficient at delivering more nutrition, not you know, and yields aren't the only thing. It isn't just how much stuff we grow. It's also how much nutrition there is and how many people really get fed with it. So that's another question. But we could also be far more efficient by borrowing techniques from, let's say, the organic movement and the kind of agroecology, as sometimes we call it, but also learning how to use high-tech approaches like precision agriculture using GPS and automated kind of sensors that let us, if we do use any chemicals, use them very precisely insofar as we only need this much in this place right now. So borrowing kind of from the organic and the conventional, we could see very big improvements in the kind of use of chemicals, water, and energy could be vastly much less than they are today. And so we could get more food with less harm to the environment if we work together.
We could do these things. Are we to any great extent?
In fact, yes. I think there are some very helpful signs. For example, deforestation in Brazil, a place that used to have massive amounts of deforestation, has dropped by about 70% in the last several years, mainly through collaboration between environmental groups and agriculture and government. It's been extraordinary. In the U.S., we've seen improvements in kind of how much food we grow for every unit of fertilizer among the conventional farmers as they're getting more precise, but also the organic farmers are getting more numerous. The organic part of the industry is getting really big, really fast, and that's, you know, kind of good signs in both areas. There are still troubling parts of the world where things are definitely not going the right way, but I guess the good news, bad news here is we kind of have to solve this problem. We don't have a choice. And so eventually we'll kind of get off our high horses and try to figure out how to do this and stop fighting and get collaborating and find ways to solve the problem.
Before we get to your last couple of recommendations, when an individual, a citizen, a voter is thinking about important issues, this might be off their radar, or if it's on their radar, it might be, seem too big and overwhelming to try to be part of a solution. Are we, as people, are policymakers starting to take this more seriously?
Well, yeah, I think at both levels. I think as individuals, we take the, you know, the food movements we see in America. People are more and more conscious of what we eat and how it affects our health and the environment around us. And that's a good thing, I think. More awareness is always a good thing if it's truly informative. But also policymakers, whether they're in government or in industry or NGOs or environmental groups, all of these different sectors are seeing food as kind of an important nexus of how we'll have to think about the future. Whether it's our economy, our environment, our security, food is pretty important. If we don't have it, we're really in trouble. So after 2008, especially when big food price spikes and even food riots were happening around the world after that, I think policymakers all over the world are getting much more concerned about our food system and how we can make it better.
Taking it to the cultural and personal level, you say another important step, changing our diets.
Yes, absolutely. The last two recommendations are first changing diets and maybe biofuels as well. And that's because, you know, what we grow isn't always what we eat. In Wisconsin, I spent about 20 years in Wisconsin. Love the state and know it well. We grow a lot of things like corn and soybeans in Wisconsin and Minnesota, where I live now, and places like Iowa. But those aren't people food. We don't eat the soybeans or the feed corn. They're fed to animals. And that's fine if you like meat and dairy products, of course. But that's not 100% efficient. You can't grow 100 calories of corn and expect to get 100 calories of beef out of that. In fact, you get about 3 of new beef production, boneless beef, that is, with 100 calories of feed added to the animal. It's pretty inefficient sometimes. Same thing, it's a little bit better for pork and chicken, but dairy is perhaps the most efficient of all. But what we see is that eating lots of animal products uses more resources, no matter what. And so we have to think wisely about how to use those resources. Now, I'm not saying everybody should become a vegetarian or anything like that overnight, but I do think we have to be more mindful of our meat and dairy production and consumption in America and think about how we can maybe do better. And that's true also around the world. And increasingly in the U.S., we also have to think about biofuels. An awful lot of the corn we grow is used for ethanol production and for animal feed. And so, you know, is that a choice we want to make? So far, the answer seems to be yes, but not everybody agrees about that. Maybe we should have a bigger discussion.
And your last recommendation, reduce food waste.
Yeah, and that's the one that, well, thankfully isn't so controversial, is food waste. Everybody seems to agree with this one, but we do so little about it. About 30 to 50% of all the food grown in the world is never eaten. In rich countries, we often, you know, throw it away in our refrigerators, our cafeterias, our dorms, whatever. But it's also true in poor countries because farmers may not be able to get their harvest to market because it spoils or it never got to the right road or the right train or whatever. So we have a lot of opportunities to increase the amount of food in the world without using a single drop more water or chemicals or land or whatever, just by being more efficient with what we've already grown. It's kind of like in Wisconsin, you know, if your house is cold, you could try to buy a bigger furnace or you could insulate your attic. Why don't we use both sides, the supply side and the demand side, to balance ourselves out and get enough food for all without compromising the environment?
So with the diet issue, you mentioned a big growing middle class around the world wanting that richer diet, two billion more people coming online in the world. Are we really going to be able to do these little steps on a big enough scale to fix this problem?
I think we can. It's not a guarantee by any means. It's going to be an awful lot of hard work. It's going to be controversial. People are not going to like some of these changes and so on. And it will have, you know, to take place over a period of time. So we have that for us, at least, and we have time to do this. But it does require some pretty big changes. We who are already here, who are already wealthy, we have to change our ways probably first before we could be telling people who are beginning to be wealthier or people yet to be born what they should be eating and how they should farm. But the good news is there are lots of opportunities using different types of farming techniques, looking at our diets, thinking about biofuels, thinking about food waste. There's no one silver bullet here, but there's a heck of a lot of silver buckshot laying around that we could use.
Jonathan, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you so much.
That was Jonathan Foley, author of National Geographic Magazine's May cover story on Feeding 9 Billion. That's kicking off an 8-month series on food. You can find more info at natgeofood.com.